Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rabbi Yaakov Glasser, and I have the great privilege of serving as the David Mitzner Dean of Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future, and it is my great honor to welcome all of you here tonight. It is really remarkable, the showing for tonight's program, and it really speaks to the incredible engagement of Yeshiva University with the broader community on issues that are certainly relevant and impactful in all of our lives. It is my honor tonight to introduce many of you to Dr. Leslie Halpert, the Dean of Yeshiva University's Firkhoff Graduate School of Psychology. Dr. Halpert earned her BA in Political Science and Master's in Educational Psychology and Special Education, both from the University at Albany SUNY, and her PhD in Clinical Psychology from Vanderbilt University. Dean Halpert's research has focused on child temperament, executive functioning, emotional regulation, coping with stress, mindfulness-based interventions for children, pediatric psychology, and parents. We could use her in this house probably right now. Dean Halpert is an accomplished researcher whose work has been funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. She has numerous publications and has presented her research at national and international conferences. We are all so excited about her visionary leadership in taking the Firkhoff Graduate School to the next level in its quest to educate, to train, and to inspire the next generation of mental health professionals in our community. As a community rabbi, I can attest to the overwhelming stress that underlies our subject tonight in the homes of many of us. It is our timeless commitment to the dignity of those who came before us, and the everlasting present necessity to confront and address contemporary realities within our homes that presents the space of both tension and opportunity that we're going to discuss tonight. Tonight's program captures the broader vision of Yeshiva University in confronting the complexities of modern life from a values-based tradition. Tonight's program indeed combines the wisdom of both our yeshiva and our university in convening our broader community to reflect and discuss a subject that is actively relevant in nearly every family throughout our community. It is a great honor to welcome you all here tonight to the family of Yeshiva University. It is my pleasure to introduce Dean Halpert.
Dr. Glaser, thank you so much for that absolutely wonderful introduction and a wonderful introduction to our very special program. It's my honor to be here this evening and to share with you two of our wonderful speakers this evening. And we have a very busy program, so we are going to try to move ahead with that. Again, thank you for that. And I welcome you all this evening to this very important topic, aging with dignity. All of us go through that life process of aging, so we are very aware ourselves of the kind of existential reality of life. And we also, all of us have parents or people who are close to us, family members, that we too watch them age over time. So this is such a pertinent issue to all of us. It's inescapable, essentially. Our first speaker tonight is Dr. Richard Zweig. Dr. Richard Zweig is a colleague and a faculty member of mine at the Firkhoff Graduate School of Psychology. He has been at Firkhoff for many years and is an expert on geropsychology. He began studying geropsychology, and that's the psychology focused on the health and mental health issues of aging and adults and seniors. He's been studying this since he essentially was a graduate student. He became interested in this topic, has been studying it for years, and truly is an expert in the area. He did his internship at Yale University. He received his doctoral degree from Northwestern University. He went on for postdoctoral training at the Rehab Institute in Neuropsychology and Medical Psychology at the Institute at Chicago at University, and he has been here for many years. He is known, in fact, at APA, very active in the Institutes for Aging. And if you actually go to the American Psychological Association, there are actually video clips of Dr. Zweig talking about geropsychology. We are thrilled that he can be with us here today. Our second speaker is Rabbi Daniel Feldman. He is Rosh Yeshiva at the Rietz Seminary at Yeshiva University. He's been an instructor at Cy Sims, our business school. He's taught at Wurzweiler. He's taught at CATS in continuing education. Obviously, he's completely engaged in the Yeshiva-wide community. Obviously a very respected member of our community. We're thrilled that he can join us today. I don't know if he's on though, because I heard he's in Brooklyn right now and trying to find a quiet spot to talk to us, but we are confident that he will join us when the time comes for him to talk. And he is going to be presenting, obviously, the very important Torah perspective on aging and dignity. And Dr. Zwei from Faircloth will be presenting the psychological perspective on aging and dignity. So we are thrilled to have both of these perspectives as our guest speakers this evening. Dr. Zweig, I believe you are the first up. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dean Halperin. I wanted to say how humbled and honored I am to be a part of this panel tonight, and to be able to share with you some thoughts about aging and dignity in the 21st century. So I'd like to begin with a story. Some years ago, I worked with a family of an older man in his late 70s, a former high school principal, who unfortunately developed dementia. Now, as some of you may know, as dementia progresses, a proportion of people, not a large proportion, a small proportion, develop psychotic symptoms, and a very small proportion can become violent. Now, as his dementia worsened to the point of psychosis, at one point he became so agitated and violent that he required psychiatric hospitalization. While in the emergency room, he had to be separated from his wife of many, many years and physically restrained in order to be taken to the psychiatric unit. Years later, his wife's memories were still haunted by the screams as he was taken away during one of the most humiliating and undignified times in his entire life. It doesn't have to be this way. So let's talk a little bit tonight, and I hope have a conversation about dignity and aging. So how do we define dignity? Well, if we go to the Oxford English Dictionary, dignity is defined as being worthy of honor or respect or the appreciation of one's self-worth. But this definition of dignity, I believe, as a quality only emanating from within, does not address other questions. Like what's the role of others or of our social environment in the experience of dignity? I'd argue, as shown here, that dignity is not only a personal experience, but an interpersonal one, defined not only by the outward expression one makes, the outward facing impression one makes on others, but also by the manner in which others respond to the individual. Now, the idea of dignity being a core ethic is shown throughout our healthcare professions. The view that dignity is not only a quality of an individual, but also something accorded to the individual by others is reflected, for example, in psychologists' code of ethics. And in fact, we have a separate principle, Principle E, respect for people's rights and dignity, which specifically says psychologists respect the dignity and worth of all people and the rights of individuals to privacy and confidentiality, but especially, I want to underscore this, self-determination. And further, that we must take special care to uphold dignity when we are involved with those who are vulnerable and suffering and whose vulnerabilities impair autonomous decision-making. And further, that part of upholding dignity is recognizing not only individual differences, including age, but to work to try to eliminate the effect of biases we may all have in regard to these individual differences. And so I'd like to suggest that in conclusion, that if healthcare professionals, essentially, if we are all granted the privilege, the honor, the freedom to provide care to another human being, especially the most vulnerable, we have the responsibility to protect that individual's rights and dignity and to be aware of factors, including our own biases, that may get in the way at times of protecting dignity. Now, these are not new ideas. Centuries ago, Maimonides and others are believed to have instructed healers in the same principles. What is new in the last century, I believe, is the widespread view that dignity is a basic human right of all human beings. And similarly, you might say, what is not new is our recognition of indignities, of obvious failures to respect the dignity of others, that we observe, for example, in instances of humiliation or degradation or dehumanization, right? But what is new, I believe, is what could be called the science of dignity, evidence that a failure to uphold others' dignity can take subtle forms, not just obvious forms, such as how we communicate. It can take the form of implicit biases that we all hold, and it can take the form of ageism, which here is defined as stereotyped beliefs and attitudes about older adults and especially about those who are most vulnerable and frail. Ageism is also reflected in using age alone as an indicator of capacity. Now, what is aging? Well, as you all know, aging is not just a biological and a personal reality, and that growing older is, we hope, inevitable, but it's also a demographic reality, in that in most developed countries, owing to both reduced mortality rates and to advances in medical treatment, we now have larger proportions of societies that are represented by older people. What is less known is how much functioning does and does not change with aging. So many of us tend to think of older adults as somehow uniformly becoming more and more disabled, which is certainly more likely the case as we get older. But take a look at these numbers. At first glance, one notices that difficulties in functioning, including difficulties hearing or doing errands alone or walking or climbing stairs, do become more common with age. But one also notices that it's not a linear relationship. It's not a linear progression. It's not as if with each advancing age, one becomes more and more disabled. In fact, most of the difficulties in functioning are most present in people over the age of 85. And most notably, even for that age group, if you flip the numbers in your head and you look at the fact that some people, in fact, over the age of 85 are, in fact, not disabled, you learn that at least a quarter and perhaps more do not experience any functional limitation. And so what I think we can conclude is that most older adults do not experience declining capabilities until at most advanced old age, and further, that functional decline or declining capacity is common, but apparently not inevitable. Now, for those who do experience some decline in functioning or what could be called intrinsic capacity, how should we respond in a manner that supports their sense of dignity? Well, I would argue that if dignity is partly an interpersonal event, one obstacle that impedes respect for dignity, according to the science, is how we communicate, something called elder speak. Communication patterns that unintentionally or implicitly reduce dignity have been referred to in the literature as elder speak. So imagine this interaction that you see pictured here. And imagine if the caregiver says, "Oh, honey, you look cold. Let me just get this blanket and tuck you in nice and tight." She might be well-meaning, but she may also be conveying stereotypes of older adults as being childlike and incapable of decision-making or autonomy. What we know from the research, the science of elder speak, is that even if well-intentioned, such communication patterns do much more harm than good, both for older adults with intact capabilities and those who have reduced capacity or who are cognitively impaired. Now, let me return to a moment to the story I began with at the beginning. The older man with violent episodes due to his dementia. When he arrived on that inpatient psychiatric unit, hospital staff could have treated him as just another psychotic, demented older man, deserving of their pity. Instead, they learned about his life. They learned that early in his life, for example, he had served in the U.S. Navy and had risen to the rank of captain. By greeting him and referring to him as the captain, they helped reduce his aggressive outbursts, helped instill pride rather than shame, and helped restore a measure of dignity, despite his illness, to the benefit of both he and his family. We've also witnessed the impact of implicit ageism, I believe, during this most recent pandemic, when some guidelines for rationing healthcare resources were based in part on age cutoffs alone, prioritizing the young over the old. Such practices were denounced by the American Geriatric Society as reinforcing persistent beliefs that older persons' lives were less valuable or even expendable. So how do we, or our public health systems, help older adults to maintain functioning and uphold dignity when capacities do decline or vulnerabilities do increase? Well, as capacities decline, as you can see here in this slide, we uphold dignity by helping older adults bridge the gap between intrinsic capacity and functional ability, as shown on the far right. Public health efforts shift from efforts to prevent or minimize disease to those that reduce barriers to participation by promoting environments, for example, that help older adults compensate. So, for example, good street lighting allows older adults with mild visual impairment to walk at night. And when there are more significant losses of capacities, for example, confinement to a wheelchair, environments such as nursing homes enable older persons to maintain or maximize their functional abilities by doing things like having banisters on the hallways so those in wheelchairs can ambulate in the wheelchair on their own, so as to preserve as much as possible their basic rights and freedoms and human dignity. How do we uphold the dignity of older adults within our healthcare systems? Well, I believe that we do it by teaching, modeling, and practicing what could be called older person-centered or integrated care, rather than conventional care. What I mean by this is basically treating the older adult as a whole person, rather than fragments or pieces of an older person subjected to different illnesses. By viewing aging as a valued part of life, by viewing older adults as active participants who can share in decision-making, by helping them to maximize their intrinsic capacities, this is what we mean by older-centered care, even in the face of disability, and especially by integrating rather than fragmenting their care across different health professionals and settings. So what do we mean by upholding dignity of older people at Yeshiva University? Well, we do this at the Furkoff Graduate School by having specialized training and service programs that focus on the mental health needs of older adults. And I want to draw your attention especially to bullet point number 3 on this slide. We do this by promoting integrated mental health care for older adults rather than fragmented care when we train our students. How do we do that? I think the best way that we can see this is through this video.
My name's Dr. Tan.
Hi, how are you? Call me Jerry.
Nice to meet you, Jerry.
Hi, I'm Aliza.
Some people have said that geriatrics is nothing if not a team enterprise.
Well, I've been having some problems.
Working in a silo doesn't work for that older patient. By definition, the problems that they were coming to you with as a psychologist or that they would come to their physician with.
And she's worried that You know, I'm forgetful and that
are often problems that have biological and psychological and social determinants.
Jacoby Hospital's in the Bronx. It's an amazingly diverse population. We have patients from all over the world. We run what we call a medicine psychology, geropsychology consultation clinic here at Jacoby, and that's the training site for the geropsychology externs as part of the FERCOF Older Adults Program.
What do you do
in the med psych clinic? We have patients who are referred from our own adult medical primary care practice and adult medical specialty practices. And so those are the patients that we see in this clinic.
Students who train here in primary care train and deliver services to older adults as part of an integrated team. That integrated team typically includes, at the least, medical residents and the psychology trainee. They are literally at times in the same room together with patients, learning from each other, as well as delivering integrated services to a patient. They are supervised jointly in real time by both a psychology professional as well as a medical professional.
And we're happy to figure out with you what's going on. It's been really great to be in this kind of multidisciplinary environment where we're able to be very independent while we're in training, and then we present each case to our supervisors. It's usually a team. Like, there'll be some residents there, there'll be both supervisors present, so we really get all the input when we're doing the supervision, and then we come back to the patient and finish up the session, and then afterwards we'll kind of connect with social work or whoever we need for resources.
The other thing that I think is worthy of a little bit more exploration, the psychologists bring that depth of understanding and that sophistication and the nuances of assessing cognitive functioning, both instrumental functioning and other functioning in the lives of our patients.
The modal patient that we see is a patient who has not been seen in the mental health services before, not had any type of, you know, professional consultation before, and may not even think of their problem as a behavioral problem. And so we train our medical residents and doctoral trainees to understand how to begin the conversation with such a patient.
Before my time in the medicine psych clinic, I was personally very afraid of patients who had psychiatric conditions. I did not know how to approach them in a manner that was meaningful, both for the patients and for my time with the patient. What questions or concerns do you have? Most definitely, I am more sensitive to a patient's psychosocial world. What's going on in their homes, for example, what's going on in their workplace, for example.
One of the benefits of us being an integrated care site is that at least coming to the clinic, a little bit of the stigma is lowered because they're going to the same place they used to go to just for their regular doctor. And so when they come in, you know, the patient may not themselves know exactly why they were referred. They'll often say, my doctor, you know, just told me to come. And so when we get a full sense of what's going on, then we can validate all the reasons that they think they're here for, and also all the reasons that we see also might be warranting attention. And so it's kind of a perfect combination that they get to come somewhere familiar, but also address new problems.
Think about the fact that the first several sessions of psychotherapy may be like that. We know from research that caregivers experience significant burden in caring for an older person with cognitive impairment. We know that they are most concerned not about the memory problems, but about the behavioral symptoms that go along with the memory problems, something that psychologists are uniquely equipped to address.
Effective care, I think, in today's world is about teams of people delivering coordinated care, and that we all understand what everyone is doing. And medicine psychology clinic is a perfect example of how a successful coordinated care system might be.
So we uphold dignity by infusing it throughout our training. Now, reflecting on dignity and aging today reminds us that the right to dignity may be one of the most fundamental and important things we do for another human being who is suffering. And I want to underscore, it needn't take the form of heroic acts. Even the act of being with another strengthens their sense of dignity, perhaps even in the face of death itself. Thankfully, as we teach and model and practice respect for the dignity of older persons, I believe others will follow in our footsteps, creating ripple effects we could not have foreseen. And if you'll permit me a moment to quell, these are my students who most recently completed their doctoral work and graduated with specialty training in geropsychology. Hear, hear. In closing, these are not new ideas, but maybe how we implement them in today's world is new. Just as we've learned about dignity from the teachings of our fathers and mothers, so too can our teachings and practices have lasting benefit. I thank you all for your attention. For any further information or for more information about our program, please feel free to contact me. I'm honored to be a part of this panel and this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are going to ask that people please hold their questions to the end. I saw a couple hands go up. So please hold the questions. And I think to make it easiest, if you have a question at the end of Rabbi Feldman speaking, you can type it into the chat box. I saw there's some concern about the volume. I hope that we can address that. Our technical experts hopefully will address that. Rabbi Feldman, are you able to join us?
I am, yes. Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yes, we do hear you. Thank you for being able to join us today.
Thank you. And it is really a tremendous honor to be a part of this program and even just listening to Dr. Zweig's presentation and hearing about all of that wonderful work. And I couldn't agree with him more. I think that's really what I'm here to address, that indeed these are not new ideas, but it's the implementation perhaps that is new. And that highlights really just how holy this work is, because of course, it is a manifestation and a realization of timeless ancient values, given focus and attention and creativity and passion and commitment. And that's what we're looking for. That's what we're here for. And it's an honor to be able to participate in this program and also to hear that presentation and to hear everything being said tonight towards that end. And there are many specifics that one can get into. I don't know how much that's necessarily what I'm supposed to do right now, but it's really just maybe give a little bit of framework and also to highlight indeed just how ancient these ideas are, because essentially what we're talking about tonight is the convergence of at least two and very often three major foundational principles of Judaism. And the idea of dignity as a whole is unquestionably one of our primary and most valued foundations. It goes back to the very beginning of creation, that humanity is created in the image of God, all of humanity. And the understanding is that a right, was also that word was used, and that's certainly the case, that a right to dignity is a part of what it means to be human. But not only is that the right to the recipient, but it is as importantly, the obligation on everyone else to convey the respect for human dignity to everyone they encounter is one of our earliest, if not really our earliest obligation, going back to that very fact of creation. It's how we show our respect for God through interacting with his creations with a sense of dignity. And this is such a crucial principle. The Talmud says five times at least, Gadol Kavod HaBrios, that this notion of human dignity, Kavod HaBrios, is a huge principle, is Gadol, is very big, so much so that it ranks very high in the hierarchy of halacha. So when we have to make policy decisions within Jewish law, the notion of protecting human dignity across the board plays a huge role in decision-making, can very often lead to overriding certain halakhic requirements. The application is very subtle and complex. I'm not going to try to lay out the parameters right here, but the notion is one that is emphasized again and again, and we find it actually to be a theme in the Torah reading next week. The idea of protecting the honor, even people who are not necessarily sterling characters, is expressed as a priority again and again. So this is something that underlines so many halachic decisions and is a major value statement that we make with how we interact with others. That includes details such as avoiding humiliation, which really is a separate obligation, the notion that how we speak to people and even how we don't speak, how we interact even without words, is regulated by a prohibition of not inflicting emotional distress and certainly not humiliation, which is considered to be an extreme version of emotional distress. And that affects how we talk, how we relate, how we interact, even facial expression, as has been pointed out in some of the earlier sources. All of that is governed by this prohibition of not inflicting emotional anguish, which is all subsumed within this idea of dignity. And this is true for everyone. But when we're dealing with the elderly, so then there is a separate value which is converging here. And we know that the Torah tells us, "Bifnei seva takum," that we are told to stand with respect when we're in the presence of the elderly. And this is separate and apart from any idea of scholarship, but simply the notion of one who has lived a long life by that very fact deserves our respect. And it's sometimes pointed out that if you go to a wedding, it seems to be somewhat of a mistaken application that as the family comes down to the processional towards the chuppah, so the bride will come and the groom will come, and the assembled stand up for the bride, they stand up for the groom. But there really isn't any actual clear source why that needs to be done. It's not really clear how that fulfills any obligation. But they don't realize that when the other family members come down, and when the grandparents come down, so then there actually is a Torah obligation, there's a biblical obligation to stand to them in recognition of their status as elders. That's a Torah obligation, very clear source of Bifnei Seva Takum. And of course, that's only one manifestation of how we're meant to relate to our elders. So when we're dealing with the dignity that comes together with aging, so then we have the convergence of two very clear and very powerful obligations within Jewish tradition. And of course, if we're dealing with elderly who happen to be our parents or grandparents, so then of course this converges with a third principle, also again independent, but coinciding with all of these considerations. And the mandate to respect one's parents is not only one of the Ten Commandments, but it may be in some ways the most significant of the Ten Commandments because it is the bridge commandment. We have a tradition that the two tablets, the first tablet represents the obligations between man and God. The second tablet represents the obligations between man and man. And therefore, the idea of respecting one's parents, which is number five, at the end of the first tablet. So what's that doing in that column? That's the idea of obligations between man and God. So many of the commentaries note that it has elements of both, that it's an interpersonal obligation for sure. It deals with how we interact with human beings, but it also is reflective of our appreciation for God and the fact that we are creations and that we are able to be given life. So we recognize not only God, but his partners in that creation, his parents, and therefore they unite in this principle. So respecting one's parents is actually the bridge between the two tablets. It's not only one of the top 10, it's not only one of the 10 commandments, but it's unique even within that 10 and occupies a crucially important place in the pantheon of our obligations. So when we're dealing certainly with our parents or our grandparents, so then we have the convergence of three huge foundations of Jewish philosophy and practice and the idea that dignity and respect for the elders and respect for our parents all call upon us to pay more attention to this than many of the other things that sometimes may occupy our thoughts and our practice. So the notion of putting these considerations front and center is very crucial. And this is true, as Dr. Zweig discussed, whether the elder individuals that we're talking about are at full capacity or if they're not at full capacity. So it doesn't necessarily change the basic value system, it changes the details, but the values are the same. And in fact, the Talmud tells us that we have to have particular attention and care with what it calls a zaken sheshachach tamudo, that if you have an elder who is no longer as sharp with all of the details as he was once upon a time, he no longer remembers all of the facts and the substance of his learning. So the Talmud tells us that we have to be especially careful with the respect of such an individual, and draws a parallel, which actually also involves the tablets. We know that we had not only two tablets, but two sets of tablets. There was a set that was used and a set that came before that that didn't get to be used. But both sets of tablets, the Talmud says, were both placed together in the ark in order to show that they both deserve respect and careful treatment. And the Talmud uses that to represent the idea that even if you have an elder who no longer remembers everything he once learned, but that doesn't diminish at all from the respect that is due to him. And the great Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchok Kook, explained that the whole notion that we respect scholarship is not because of the details, it's not because of the perfect memory and recall and command of all the facts, it's because we recognize the ennobling effect of that scholarship and the character development, which remains even when the details and the facts and perhaps even much more basic information is no longer able to be accessed. The impact of a life well lived is still there in the character of the individual, and the respect that we show is not one whit diminished. And this is true whether we're talking about a scholar of Torah or of any other discipline of life and any other experience that causes an individual to be ennobled and to deserve the acknowledgement of a life well lived. So this is true for their treatment, regardless of how much of that is still evident and how they're able to interact with that stage. And remembering that and making sure that that factors in how they are treated is highlighted here again as a principle which goes back to here the visual symbol of the Ten Commandments. And that's also something that we place at a very high level in our halachic considerations. So those are some of the values that guide the decision. And just quickly point to some of the ways in which this impacts the decisions. So we know, first of all, that this idea of human dignity, again, really for anyone whose human dignity is threatened, but the considerations of an elder are often multiplied and often have a greater aspect to them, both in terms of whatever frustration comes from having transitions from a life where one was perhaps a little bit more agile and a little bit more capable and not being able to function in that capacity 100%. So the emotional aspect is even stronger. And the idea that one has to be sensitive and aware of what that's like is a very powerful consideration, which, for example, influences the laws of Shabbos, that we know that on Shabbos we have certain limitations in terms of how we get around and how we communicate, and those have to be navigated. But when we have to worry that somebody is in a situation that they're being emotionally isolated because of that, and they're not able to communicate, they're not able to interact with others the way that they otherwise would have been. So we are cognizant of the fact that that impacts their dignity. It also impacts sometimes their lifespan, because the ability to interact and to communicate and to be included is so crucial to one's sense of self and one's desire to keep existing in that kind of a context, that that also factors into how we assess the laws of Shabbos and various details, which would impact on those kinds of considerations. So the need to make sure that one is cared for, to make sure that one is included in the emotional connections and conversations when possible, in social interactions, play a very large role in how we make these decisions and how that's evaluated. We recognize that that is all a part of dignity, and that's all a part of one's mental well-being and one's essentially one's health. And certainly over the past year and a half, when COVID had created such barriers to interaction and to social connectedness, so that also required greater compensation for what's missing. And that was also a very major part of how decisions were made and how these details were assessed. And you find in the laws of tzedakah, in the laws of charity, that if somebody used to be wealthy, and they're no longer as wealthy as they once were, so then the obligations of charity require us not only to feed and to provide sustenance to the poor who don't have very basic necessities, but even somebody who wouldn't be considered poor but used to be treated with a great luxury and now is no longer in that situation. We have to be sensitive to the emotional impact. And we understand that that's not only about money. It's also about time, attention, and honor also. If somebody was in a position where they used to receive a lot of respect, they used to receive a lot of attention, a lot of interaction, and they're no longer in that position. So that's something that can be very emotionally painful. And that same obligation within the laws of charity require us to pay attention to that as well. And of course, there are all kinds of family considerations, the sandwich generation, and those who are obligated to care for their parents at the same time as they're also obligated to care for a spouse and for children. And here the halacha has a careful balance of priorities of where we have to put our attention if we have to choose between one or the other. And that needs to be the case because there is always a primary responsibility to the nuclear family, to one's spouse and to one's children. But at the same time, all the commentaries point out that that's only when you're forced to choose. But to the extent that it's possible to balance the two and to be able to also balance the need to take care of a spouse and children together with taking care of an elderly parent or grandparent, that is both necessary and also a crucial message to send to the next generation at the same time. So we do whatever we can to try to make sure that that is all factored into the consideration and that that is all balanced in with what we're doing. Now, sometimes we talk about the respect of parents, and I'm almost out of time, so I'll just mention this detail. But it's also very often the case that with an elderly parent, so if the capacity is diminished, that creates some kinds of unique challenges as far as communicating and as far as how the dignity of the parent can be respected. And here the codes talk about this at length. And Maimonides, for example, talked about the situation of a parent who is not in full competency, doesn't necessarily have the full faculties that they had, and how the child is obligated to find a way to communicate that is compassionate and that is sensitive. And if it reaches a stage where they don't feel they're capable of doing that, so then they have to make sure that there are others who can fill that role, even while they may need to keep a distance. And the recognition that there are services that need to happen because a parent needs to be attended to, but may not be appropriate for the child and may not be possible for the child to perform directly while still maintaining all of the aspects of dignity that a parent would regularly appreciate, would be able to make those decisions, is a very major factor in assessing those halachic considerations. And there's a major discussion back and forth, the way the Maimonides formulated it, the way some of the commentaries questioned at various aspects of that balance. All of that is a very lively discussion that continues to this day, but highlights the need for a great sensitivity and care in managing that balance. And it creates an even greater sense of gratitude and appreciation that there are organizations that are committed to assisting with that balance in such magnificent ways.
Rabbi Feldman, thank you for that wonderful commentary. It is just really fascinating to hear how, you know, so many of the issues that are studied in geropsychology from a more secular perspective dovetails so, you know, almost symbiotically with what's written in the Torah and the Halakha. And so the instructions for essentially dealing with our elders are universal instructions of care and love and dignity. And it is just really striking to hear how the guidance from the Torah and Halakha is there to ensure that the younger generation cares for its elderly also. So thank you for that very wonderful commentary. Dr. Zweig, thank you for that commentary also. I just checked our time and I do believe we are out of time right now. We're supposed to be ending this. I don't know, Rabbi Glazer, are you going to make some comments, I think, at this point also?
Yes, I'm just going to share some closing thoughts. Really, first of all, just to thank Dean Halpern, Dr. Zweig, Rabbi Feldman, for just a fascinating tour de force of so many different dimensions of this very critical and very central aspect of the lives of so many in our community. So thank you so much for everything you've shared. I just want to acknowledge also the presence of Dan Satlow from our institutional advancement team. To a large degree, this program was his vision. And he is someone we invite everyone to be in touch with insofar as how you could get more involved in supporting the great work of FERCOF, the great work of Yeshiva University, programs such as these. And I also want to acknowledge, because I see her here on the screen, Professor Schramm, who's with us, who certainly is a treasure of Yeshiva University and our community for many, many years. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for participating this evening. For those who are part of our President's Society, the program continues with an exclusive gathering with our speakers. If for some reason you did not have the opportunity to receive that link, please be in touch with Dov Winston, who posted his email in the chat. And to everyone else, it is wonderful to see all of you. We wish you a safe and relaxing and inspirational and wonderful summer. And we are so excited about the upcoming year of Yeshiva University to be back with our students, engaged face-to-face, full-time, in a full, please God, as much as possible. And also especially for the FERCOF Graduate School, the work that they do in the community, beyond just the students of Yeshiva University, which is just remarkable and a true testament to everything that YU is about and everything that the FERCOF Graduate School is about. So thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and have a wonderful summer.